rather fatter, rather whiter, the admirable Hugh. He looked always as if he were on duty, thought Peter, a privileged but secretive being, hoarding secrets which he would die to defend, though it was only some little piece of tittle-tattle dropped by a court footman, which would be in all the papers tomorrow. Such were his rattles, his baubles, in playing with which he had grown white, come to the verge of old age, enjoying the respect and affection of all who had the privilege of knowing this type of the English public schoolman. Inevitably one made up things like that about Hugh. That was his style. The style of those admirable letters which Peter had read thousands of miles across the sea in the Times, and had thanked God he was out of that pernicious hubble-bubble, if it were only to hear baboons chatter and coolies beat their wives. An olive-skinned youth from one of the universities stood obsequiously by. Him he would patronise, initiate, teach how to get on. For he liked nothing better than doing kindnesses, making the hearts of old ladies palpitate with the joy of being thought of in their age, their affliction, thinking themselves quite forgotten. Yet here was dear Hugh, driving up and spending an hour talking of the past, remembering trifles, praising the homemade cake, though Hugh might eat cake with the Duchess any day of his life, and to look at him, probably did spend a good deal of time in that agreeable occupation. The all-judging, the all-merciful, might excuse. Peter Walsh had no mercy. Villains there must be, and God knows the rascals who get hanged for battering the brains of a girl out in a train do less harm on the whole than Hugh Whitbread and his kindness. Look at him now, on tiptoe, dancing forward, bowing and scraping, as the Prime Minister and Lady Bruton emerged, intimating for all the world to see that he was privileged to say something, something private, to Lady Bruton as she passed. She stopped. She wagged her fine old head. She was thanking him, presumably, for some piece of servility. She had her toadies, minor officials and government officers, who ran about putting through little jobs on her behalf, in return for which she gave them luncheon. But she derived from the 18th century. She was all right. This late age of the world's experience had bred in them all men and women, a well of tears. Tears and sorrows, courage and endurance, a perfectly upright and stoical bearing. Think, for example, of the woman she admired most, Lady Bexborough, opening the bazaar. There were Jorrocks jaunts and jollities. There were Soapy Sponge and Mrs. Asquith's memoirs and big game shooting in Nigeria, all spread open. Ever so many books there were, but none that seemed exactly right to take to Evelyn Whitbread in her nursing home. Nothing that would serve to amuse her and make that indescribably dried-up little woman look, as Clarissa came in, just for a moment cordial, before they settled down for the usual interminable talk of women's ailments. How much she wanted it, that people should look pleased as she came in, Clarissa thought, and turned and walked back towards Bond Street, annoyed, because it was silly to have other reasons for doing things. Much rather would she have been one of those people like Richard, who did things for themselves. Whereas, she thought, waiting to cross, half the time she did things not simply, not for themselves, but to make people think this or that. Perfect idiocy, she knew. And now the policeman held up his hand, for no one was ever for a second taken in. Oh, if she could have had her life over again, she thought, stepping onto the pavement, could have looked even differently. She would have been, in the first place, dark, like Lady Bexborough, with a skin of crumpled leather and beautiful eyes. She would have been, like Lady Bexborough, slow and stately, rather large, interested in politics like a man, with a country house, very dignified, very sincere. Instead of which, she had a narrow pea-stick figure, a ridiculous little face, beat like a bird's. That she held herself well was true, and had nice hands and feet, and dressed well, considering that she spent little. But often now this body she wore, she stopped to look at a Dutch picture, this body with all its capacities seemed nothing, nothing at all. She had the oddest sense of being herself invisible, unseen, unknown. There being no more marrying, no more having of children now, but only this astonishing and rather solemn progress with the rest of them up Bond Street, this being Mrs. Dalloway, not even Clarissa any more, this being Mrs. Richard Dalloway. Bond Street fascinated her. Bond Street early in the morning in the season, its flags flying, its shops, no splash, no glitter, one roll of tweed in the shop where her father had bought his suits for 50 years. A few pearls, salmon on an ice block. "That is all," she said, looking at the fishmongers. "That is all," she repeated, pausing for a moment at the window of a glove shop, where, before the war, you could buy almost perfect gloves. And her old Uncle William used to say a lady is known by her shoes and her gloves. He had turned on his bed one morning in the middle of the war. He had said, "I have had enough." Gloves and shoes. She had a passion for gloves, but her own daughter, her Elizabeth, cared not a straw for either of them. Not a straw, she thought, going on up Bond Street to a shop where they kept flowers for her when she gave a party. Elizabeth really cared for her dog most of all. The whole house this morning smelt of tar. Still, better poor Grizzle than Miss Kilman. Better distemper and tar and all the rest of it than sitting mewed in a stuffy bedroom with a prayer book. Better anything, she was inclined to say. But it might be only a phase, as Richard said, such as all girls go through. It might be falling in love. But why with Miss Kilman? Who had been badly treated, of course, one must make allowances for that. And Richard said she was very able, had a really historical mind. Anyhow, they were inseparable, and Elizabeth, her own daughter, went to communion. Her evening dresses hung in the cupboard. Clarissa, plunging her hand into the softness, gently detached the green dress and carried it to the window. She had torn it. Someone had trod on the skirt. She'd felt it give at the embassy party, at the top among the folds. By artificial light, the green shone, but lost its colour now in the sun. She would mend it. Her maids had too much to do. She would wear it tonight. She would take her silks, her scissors, her thimble, of course, down into the drawing-room, for she must also write and see that things generally were more or less in order. Strange, she thought, pausing on the landing and assembling that diamond shape, that single person. Strange how a mistress knows the very moment, the very temper of her house. Faint sounds rose in spirals up the well of the stairs. The swish of a mop. Tapping. Knocking. A loudness when the front door opened. A voice repeating a message in the basement. The chink of silver on a tray. Clean silver for the party. All was for the party. And Lucy, coming into the drawing-room with her tray held out, put the giant candlesticks on the mantelpiece, the silver casket in the middle, turned the crystal dolphin towards the clock. They would come, they would stand, they would talk in the mincing tones which she could imitate, ladies and gentlemen. Of all, her mistress was loveliest, mistress of silver, of linen, of china. For the sun, the silver, doors off their hinges, Rumpelmeyer's men, gave her a sense, as she laid the paper knife on the inlaid table, of something achieved. "Behold, behold," she said, speaking to her old friends in the baker's shop, where she had first seen service at Caterham, prying into the glass. She was Lady Angela, attending Princess Mary, when in came Mrs. Dalloway. "Oh, Lucy," she said, "the silver does look nice." "And how," she said, turning the crystal dolphin to stand straight, "how did you enjoy the play last night?" "Oh, they had to go before the end," she said. "They had to be back at 10, she said, "so they don't know what happened," she said. "That does seem hard luck," she said, for her servant stayed later, if they asked her. "That does seem rather a shame," she said, taking the old, bald-looking cushion in the middle of the sofa and putting it in Lucy's arms and giving her a little push and crying, "Take it away! Give it to Mrs. Walker with my compliments! Take it away!" she cried. And Lucy stopped at the drawing-room door, holding the cushion, and said, very shyly, turning a little pink, couldn't she help to mend that dress? "But," said Mrs. Dalloway, "she had enough on her hands already, quite enough of her own to do without that." "But thank you, Lucy, oh, thank you," said Mrs. Dalloway. And thank you, thank you, she went on saying, sitting down on the sofa with her dress over her knees, her scissors, her silks. "Thank you, thank you," she went on saying in gratitude to her servants generally, for helping her to be like this, to be what she wanted, gentle, generous-hearted. Her servants liked her. "And then this dress of hers, where was the tear, and now her needle to be threaded? This was a favourite dress, one of Sally Parker's, the last almost she ever made, alas, for Sally had now retired, living at Ealing. And if ever I have a moment," thought Clarissa, but never would she have a moment any more, "I shall go and see her at Ealing." For she was a character, thought Clarissa, a real artist. She thought of little out-of-the-way things, yet her dresses were never queer. You could wear them at Hatfield, at Buckingham Palace. She had worn them at Hatfield, at Buckingham Palace. She was close to him now, could see him staring at the sky, muttering, clasping his hands. Yet Dr. Holmes said there was nothing the matter with him. What then had happened? Why had he gone, then? Why, when she sat by him, did he start, frown at her, move away, and point at her hand, take her hand, look at it, terrified? Was it that she had taken off her wedding ring? "My hand has grown so thin," she said. "I have put it in my purse," she told him. He dropped her hand. Their marriage was over, he thought, with agony, with relief. The rope was cut. He mounted. He was free, as it was decreed that he, Septimus, the Lord of Men, should be free. Alone, since his wife had thrown away her wedding ring, since she had left him, he, Septimus, was alone, called forth in advance of the mass of men to hear the truth, to learn the meaning, which now at last, after all the toils of civilization, Greeks, Romans, Shakespeare, Darwin, and now himself, was to be given whole to... "To whom?" he asked aloud. "To the Prime Minister," the voices which rustled above his head replied. "The supreme secret must be told to the cabinet. First, that trees are alive. Next, there is no crime. Next, love, universal love," he muttered, gasping, trembling, painfully drawing out these profound truths, which needed, so deep were they, so difficult, an immense effort to speak out, but the world was entirely changed by them forever. "No crime. Love," he repeated, fumbling for his card and pencil, when a Skye terrier snuffed his trousers and he started in an agony of fear. It was turning into a man. He couldn't watch it happen. It was horrible, terrible to see a dog become a man. At once the dog trotted away. Heaven was divinely merciful, infinitely benignant. It spared him, pardoned his weakness. But what was the scientific explanation? For one must be scientific above all things. Why could he see through bodies, see into the future when dogs will become men? It was the heat wave, presumably, operating upon a brain made sensitive by eons of evolution. Scientifically speaking, the flesh was melted off the world. His body was macerated until only the nerve fibers were left. It was spread like a veil upon a rock. It was at that moment, Rezia gone shopping, that the great revelation took place. A voice spoke from behind the screen. Evans was speaking. The dead were with him. "Evans! Evans!" he cried. Mr. Smith was talking aloud to himself, Agnes the servant girl cried to Mrs. Filmer in the kitchen. "Evans! Evans!" he had said as she brought in the tray. She jumped, she did. She scuttled downstairs. And Rezia came in with her flowers and walked across the room and put the roses in a vase upon which the sun struck directly, and it went laughing, leaping round the room. She had had to buy the roses, Rezia said, from a poor man in the street. But they were almost dead already, she said, arranging the roses. So there was a man outside. Evans, presumably. And the roses, which Rezia said were half dead, had been picked by him in the fields of Greece. "Communication is health. Communication is happiness. Communication," he muttered. "What are you saying, Septimus?" Rezia asked, wild with terror, for he was talking to himself. She sent Agnes running for Dr. Holmes. Her husband, she said, was mad. He scarcely knew her. "You brute! You brute!" cried Septimus, seeing human nature, that is, Dr. Holmes, enter the room. "Now what's all this about?" said Dr. Holmes in the most amiable way in the world. "Talking nonsense to frighten your wife?" But he would give him something to make him sleep. "And if they were rich people," said Dr. Holmes, looking ironically round the room, "by all means let them go to Harley Street." "If they had no confidence in him," said Dr. Holmes, looking not quite so kind. Shuffling the edges straight, she did up the papers and tied the parcel almost without looking. Sitting beside him, he thought, as if all her petals were about her. She was a flowering tree, and through her branches looked out the face of a lawgiver, who had reached a sanctuary where she feared no one, not Holmes, not Bradshaw. A miracle, a triumph, the last and greatest. Staggering, he saw her mount the appalling staircase, laden with Holmes and Bradshaw, men who never weighed less than 11 stone 6, who sent their wives to court, men who made 10,000 a year and talked of proportion, who, different in their verdicts, for Holmes said one thing, Bradshaw another, yet judges they were, who mixed the vision and the sideboard, saw nothing clear, yet ruled, yet inflicted. "Must," they said. Over them she triumphed. "There," she said. The papers were tied up. No one should get at them. She would put them away. And, she said, nothing should separate them. She sat down beside him and called him by the name of that hawk or crow which, being malicious and a great destroyer of crops, was precisely like him. No one could separate them, she said. Then she got up to go into the bedroom to pack their things. But hearing voices downstairs and thinking that Dr. Holmes had perhaps called, ran down to prevent him coming up. Septimus could hear her talking to Holmes on the staircase. "My dear lady, I have come as a friend," Holmes was saying. "No, I will not allow you to see my husband," she said. He could see her, like a little hen, with her wings spread, barring his passage. But Holmes persevered. "My dear lady, allow me," Holmes said, putting her aside. Holmes was a powerfully built man. Holmes was coming upstairs. Holmes would burst open the door. Holmes would say, "In a funk, eh?" Holmes would get him. But no, not Holmes, not Bradshaw. getting up rather unsteadily, hopping indeed from foot to foot. He considered Mrs. Filmer's nice clean bread knife, with bread carved on the handle. Ah, but one mustn't spoil that. The gas fire? But it was too late now. Holmes was coming. Razors he might have got, but Rezia, who always did that sort of thing, had packed them. There remained only the window, the large Bloomsbury lodging-house window, the tiresome, the troublesome and rather melodramatic business of opening the window and throwing himself out. It was their idea of tragedy, not his or Rezia's, for she was with him. Holmes and Bradshaw liked that sort of thing. He sat on the sill. But he would wait till the very last moment. He didn't want to die. Life was good, the sun hot. Only human beings, what did they want? Coming down the staircase opposite, an old man stopped and stared at him. Holmes was at the door. "I'll give it to you," he cried, and flung himself vigorously, violently, down onto Mrs. Filmer's area railings. "The coward!" cried Dr. Holmes, bursting the door open. Rezia ran to the window. She saw. She understood. Dr. Holmes and Mrs. Filmer collided with each other. Mrs. Filmer flapped her apron and made her hide her eyes in the bedroom. There was a great deal of running up and downstairs. Dr. Holmes came in, white as a sheet, shaking all over, with a glass in his hand. "She must be brave and drink something," he said. What was it? Something sweet. For her husband was horribly mangled, would not recover consciousness. She must not see him, must be spared as much as possible. Would have the inquest to go through, poor young woman. Who could have foretold it? A sudden impulse. No one was in the least to blame, he told Mrs. Filmer. And why the devil he did it, Dr. Holmes could not conceive. And now Clarissa escorted her Prime Minister down the room, prancing, sparkling, with the stateliness of her grey hair. She wore earrings and a silver-green mermaid's dress, lolloping on the waves and braiding her tresses, she seemed, having that gift still, to be, to exist, to sum it all up in the moment as she passed, turned, caught her scarf in some other woman's dress, unhitched it, laughed, all with the most perfect ease and air of a creature floating in its element. But age had brushed her, even as a mermaid might behold in her glass the setting sun on some very clear evening over the waves. There was a breath of tenderness. Her severity, her prudery, her woodenness were all warmed through now, and she had about her, as she said goodbye to the thick, gold-laced man who was doing his best, and good luck to him, to look important, an inexpressible dignity, an exquisite cordiality, as if she wished the whole world well, and must now, being on the very verge and rim of things, take her leave. So she made him think. But he was not in love. Indeed, Clarissa felt, the Prime Minister had been good to come. And walking down the room with him, with Sally there and Peter there and Richard very pleased, with all those people rather inclined, perhaps, to envy, she had felt that intoxication of the moment, that dilatation of the nerves of the heart itself, till it seemed to quiver, steeped, upright. Yes, but after all, it was what other people felt, that... For though she loved it and felt it tingle and sting, still these semblances, these triumphs, dear old Peter, for example, thinking her so brilliant, had a hollowness. At arm's length they were, not in the heart. And it might be that she was growing old, but they satisfied her no longer as they used. And suddenly, as she saw the Prime Minister go down the stairs, the gilt rim of the Sir Joshua picture of the little girl with a muff brought back Kilman with a rush. Kilman, her enemy. That was satisfying. That was real. Ah, how she hated her! Hot, hypocritical, corrupt, with all that power. Elizabeth's seducer, the woman who had crept in to steal and defile. Richard would say, what nonsense. She hated her. She loved her. It was enemies one wanted, not friends. Not Mrs. Durant and Clara, Sir William and Lady Bradshaw, Miss Trulock and Eleanor Gibson, whom she saw coming upstairs. They must find her if they wanted her. She was for the party. And how she dressed, how she treated people who came to lunch, she didn't care a bit, being her experience that the religious ecstasy made people callous. So did causes. Dulled their feelings. For Miss Kilman would do anything for the Russians, starved herself for the Austrians, but in private inflicted positive torture, so insensitive was she, dressed in a green Mackintosh coat. Year in, year out, she wore that coat. She perspired. She was never in the room 5 minutes without making you feel her superiority, your inferiority. How poor she was, how rich you were, how she lived in a slum without a cushion or a bed or a rug or whatever it might be, all her soul rusted with that grievance sticking in it. Her dismissal from school during the war. Poor, embittered, unfortunate creature. For it was not her one hated, but the idea of her, which undoubtedly had gathered into itself a great deal that was not Miss Kilman, had become one of those spectres with which one battles in the night. One of those spectres who stand astride us and suck up half our lifeblood, dominators and tyrants. For no doubt, with another throw of the dice, had the black been uppermost and not the white, she would have loved Miss Kilman. But not in this world. No. It rasped her, though, to have stirring about in her this brutal monster, to hear twigs cracking and feel hooves planted down in the depths of that leaf-encumbered forest, the soul. Never to be content quite, or quite secure, for at any moment the brute would be stirring, this hatred, which, especially since her illness, had power to make her feel scraped, hurt in her spine, gave her physical pain, and made all pleasure in beauty, in friendship, in being well, in being loved and making her home delightful, rock, quiver, and bend, as if indeed there were a monster grubbing at the roots, as if the whole panoply of content were nothing but self-love. This hatred. Nonsense, nonsense, she cried to herself, pushing through the swing doors of Mulberry's the florist's. She advanced, light, tall, very upright, to be greeted at once by button-faced Miss Pym, whose hands were always bright red, as if they had been stood in cold water with the flowers. There were flowers, delphiniums, sweet peas, bunches of lilac, and carnations, masses of carnations. There were roses, there were irises. Ah, yes. So she breathed in the earthy garden sweet smell as she stood talking to Miss Pym, who owed her help, and thought her kind, for kind she had been years ago. Very kind, but she looked older this year, turning her head from side to side among the irises and roses and nodding tufts of lilac with her eyes half closed, snuffing in, after the street uproar, the delicious scent, the exquisite coolness. And then, opening her eyes, how fresh, like frilled linen cleaned from a laundry laid in wicker trays, the roses looked, and dark and prim the red carnations holding their heads up, and all the sweet peas spreading in their bowls, tinged violet, snow-white, pale. As if it were the evening, and girls in muslin frocks came out to pick sweet peas and roses, after the superb summer's day, with its almost blue-black sky, its delphiniums, its carnations, its arum lilies, was over. And it was the moment between 6 and 7, when every flower, roses, carnations, irises, lilac, glows. White, violet, red, deep orange. Every flower seems to burn by itself, softly, purely in the misty beds. And how she loved the grey-white moths spinning in and out, over the cherry pie, over the evening primroses. And as she began to go with Miss Pym from jar to jar, choosing, "Nonsense, nonsense," she said to herself, more and more gently, as if this beauty, this scent, this colour, and Miss Pym, liking her, trusting her, were a wave which she let flow over her and surmount that hatred, that monster, surmount it all. And it lifted her up and up when, oh, a pistol shot in the street outside. "Dear, those motor cars," said Miss Pym, going to the window to look, and coming back and smiling apologetically with her hands full of sweet peas, as if those motor cars, those tires of motor cars, were all her fault. Quiet descended on her, calm, content, as her needle, drawing the silk smoothly to its gentle paws, collected the green folds together and attached them, very lightly, to the belt. So, on a summer's day, waves collect, overbalance, and fall. Collect and fall. And the whole world seems to be saying, "That is all," more and more ponderously, until even the heart in the body which lies in the sun on the beach says too, "That is all." "Fear no more," says the heart. "Fear no more," says the heart, committing its burden to some sea which sighs collectively for all sorrows and renews, begins, collects, lets fall. And the body alone listens to the passing bee, the wave breaking, the dog barking, far away barking and barking. "Heavens, the front door bell!" exclaimed Clarissa, staying her needle. Roused, she listened. "Mrs. Dalloway will see me," said the elderly man in the hall. "Oh, yes, she will see me," he repeated, putting Lucy aside very benevolently and running upstairs ever so quickly. "Yes, yes, yes," he muttered as he ran upstairs. "She will see me. After 5 years in India, Clarissa will see me."
"Who can, what can?" asked Mrs. Dalloway, thinking it was outrageous to be interrupted at 11 o'clock on the morning of the day she was giving a party. Hearing a step on the stairs, she heard a hand upon the door. She made to hide her dress, like a virgin protecting chastity, respecting privacy. Now the brass knob slipped. Now the door opened. And in came, for a single second, she couldn't remember what he was called, so surprised she was to see him, so glad, so shy, so utterly taken aback to have Peter Walsh come to her unexpectedly in the morning. She had not read his letter. "And how are you?" said Peter Walsh, positively trembling, taking both her hands, kissing both her hands. "She's grown older," he thought, sitting down. "I shan't tell her anything about it," he thought, "for she's grown older." "She's looking at me," he thought, a sudden embarrassment coming over him, though he had kissed her hands. Putting his hand into his pocket, he took out a large pocket knife and half opened the blade. "Exactly the same," thought Clarissa. "The same queer look, the same check suit. A little out of the straight his face is, a little thinner, drier perhaps, but he looks awfully well, and just the same." "How heavenly it is to see you again," she exclaimed. He had his knife out. "That's so like him," she thought. "He had only reached town last night," he said. "Would have to go down into the country at once. And how was everything? How was everybody? Richard? Elizabeth?" "And what's all this?" he said, tilting his penknife towards her green dress. "He's very well dressed," thought Clarissa. "Yet he always criticises me." "Here she is, mending her dress. Mending her dress as usual," he thought. Here she's been sitting all the time I've been in India, mending her dress, playing about, going to parties, running to the house and back, and all that, he thought, growing more and more irritated, more and more agitated. For there's nothing in the world so bad for some women as marriage, he thought, and politics, and having a conservative husband like the Admirable Richard. So it is, he thought, shutting his knife with a snap. He lay back in his chair, exhausted but upheld. He lay resting, waiting before he again interpreted with effort, with agony to mankind. He lay very high on the back of the world. The earth thrilled beneath him. Red flowers grew through his flesh. Their stiff leaves rustled by his head. Music began clanging against the rocks up here. It is a motor horn down in the street, he muttered, but up here it cannoned from rock to rock, divided, met in shocks of sound which rose in smooth columns. That music should be visible was a discovery, and became an anthem. An anthem twined round now by a shepherd boy's piping. That's an old man playing a penny whistle by the public house, he muttered, which, as the boy stood still, came bubbling from his pipe, and then, as he climbed higher, made its exquisite plaint while the traffic passed beneath. This boy's elegy is played among the traffic, thought Septimus. Now he withdraws up into the snows, and roses hang about him. The thick red roses which grow on my bedroom wall, he reminded himself. The music stopped. He has his penny, he reasoned it out, and has gone on to the next public house. But he himself remained high on his rock, like a drowned sailor on a rock. I leant over the edge of the boat and fell down, he thought. I went under the sea. I have been dead, and yet am now alive. But let me rest still, he begged. He was talking to himself again. It was awful, awful. And as, before waking, the voices of birds and the sound of wheels chime and chatter in a queer harmony, grow louder and louder, and the sleeper feels himself drawing to the shores of life, so he felt himself drawing towards life. The sun growing hotter, cries sounding louder, something tremendous about to happen. He had only to open his eyes, but a weight was on them, a fear. He strained, he pushed, he looked. He saw Regent's Park before him. Long streamers of sunlight fawned at his feet. The trees waved, brandished. We welcome, the world seemed to say. We accept, we create. Beauty, the world seemed to say. And as if to prove it, scientifically, wherever he looked, at the houses, at the railings, at the antelopes stretching over the palings, beauty sprang instantly. To watch a leaf quivering in the rush of air was an exquisite joy. Up in the sky, swallows swooping, swerving, flinging themselves in and out, round and round, yet always with perfect control, as if elastics held them. And the flies rising and falling. And the sun spotting now this leaf, now that, in mockery, dazzling it with soft gold in pure good temper. And now and again some chime, it might be a motor horn, tinkling divinely on the grass stalks. All of this, calm and reasonable as it was, made out of ordinary things as it was the truth now. Beauty, that was the truth now. Beauty was everywhere. It is time, said Rezia. It was precisely 12 o'clock. 12 by Big Ben, whose stroke was wafted over the northern part of London, blent with that of other clocks, mixed in a thin, ethereal way with the clouds and wisps of smoke, and died up there among the seagulls. 12 o'clock struck, as Clarissa Dalloway laid her green dress on her bed, and the Warren Smiths walked down Harley Street. 12 was the hour of their appointment. Probably, Rezia thought, that was Sir William Bradshaw's house with the grey motor car in front of it. The leaden circles dissolved in the air. Indeed it was Sir William Bradshaw's motor car. Low, powerful, grey, with plain initials interlocked on the panel, as if the pomps of heraldry were incongruous, this man being the ghostly helper, the priest of science. And as the motor car was grey, so, to match its sober suavity, grey furs, silver-grey rugs, were heaped in it to keep her ladyship warm while she waited. For often Sir William would travel 60 miles or more down into the country to visit the rich, the afflicted, who could afford the very large fee which Sir William very properly charged for his advice. Her ladyship waited with the rugs about her knees an hour or more, leaning back, thinking sometimes of the patient, sometimes, excusably, of the wall of gold mounting minute by minute while she waited. The wall of gold that was mounting between them and all shifts and anxieties. She had borne them bravely. They had had their struggles, until she felt wedged on a calm ocean where only spice winds blow. Respected, admired, envied, with scarcely anything left to wish for, though she regretted her stoutness. Large dinner parties every Thursday night to the profession. An occasional bazaar to be opened. Royalty greeted. Too little time, alas, with her husband, whose work grew and grew. A boy doing well at Eton. She would have liked a daughter, too. Interests she had, however, in plenty. Child welfare, the aftercare of the epileptic, and photography. So that if there was a church building, or a church decaying, she bribed the sexton, got the key, and took photographs, which were scarcely to be distinguished from the work of professionals, while she waited. Sir William himself was no longer young. He had worked very hard. He had won his position by sheer ability, being the son of a shopkeeper. Loved his profession, made a fine figurehead at ceremonies, and spoke well. All of which had, by the time he was knighted, given him a heavy look, a weary look, the stream of patients being so incessant, the responsibilities and privileges of his profession so onerous. Which weariness, together with his grey hairs, increased the extraordinary distinction of his presence, and gave him the reputation, of the utmost importance in dealing with nerve cases, not merely of lightning skill and almost infallible accuracy in diagnosis, but of sympathy, tact, understanding of the human soul. It seemed to her, as she drank the sweet stuff, that she was opening long windows, stepping out into some garden. But where? The clock was striking. 1, 2, 3. How sensible the sound was, compared with all this thumping and whispering, like Septimus himself. She was falling asleep, but the clock went on striking, 4, 5, 6, and Mrs. Filmer, waving her apron, they wouldn't bring the body in here, would they? Seemed part of that garden. Or a flag. She had once seen a flag slowly rippling out from a mast, when she stayed with her aunt at Venice. Men killed in battle were thus saluted, and Septimus had been through the war. Of her memories, most were happy. She put on her hat and ran through cornfields. Where could it have been? Onto some hill, somewhere near the sea, for there were ships, gulls, butterflies. They sat on a cliff. In London, too, there they sat. And, half-dreaming, came to her through the bedroom door, rain falling, whisperings, stirrings among dry corn, the caress of the sea, as it seemed to her,
hollowing them in its arched shell and murmuring to her laid on shore, strewn, she felt, like flying flowers over some tomb. "He is dead," she said, smiling at the poor old woman who guarded her with her honest light blue eyes fixed on the door. "They wouldn't bring him in here, would they?" But Mrs. Filmer pooh-poohed. "Oh, no, oh, no! They were carrying him away now. Ought she not to be told? Married people ought to be together," Mrs. Filmer thought. "But they must do as the doctor said."
"Let her sleep," said Dr. Holmes, feeling her pulse. She saw the large outline of his body standing dark against the window. So that was Dr. Holmes. There was her old friend, Sir Harry. "Dear Sir Harry," she said, going up to the fine old fellow who had produced more bad pictures than any other two academicians in the whole of St. John's Wood. They were always of cattle, standing in sunset pools, absorbing moisture, or signifying, for he had a certain range of gesture, by the raising of one foreleg and the toss of the antlers, the approach of the stranger. All his activities, dining out, racing, were founded on cattle standing absorbing moisture in sunset pools. "What are you laughing at?" she asked him, for Willie Titcomb and Sir Harry and Herbert Ainsty were all laughing. But no, Sir Harry could not tell Clarissa Dalloway, much though he liked her, of her type, he thought her perfect, and threatened to paint her, his stories of the music hall stage. He chaffed her about her party. He missed his brandy. These circles, he said, were above him. But he liked her, respected her, in spite of her damnable, difficult upper-class refinement, which made it impossible to ask Clarissa Dalloway to sit on his knee. And up came that wandering will-o'-the-wisp, that vagulous phosphorescence, old Mrs. Hilbury, stretching her hands to the blaze of his laughter about the Duke and the lady, which, as she heard it across the room, seemed to reassure her on a point which sometimes bothered her if she woke early in the morning and did not like to call her maid for a cup of tea, how it is certain we must die. "They won't tell us their stories," said Clarissa. "Dear Clarissa," exclaimed Mrs. Hilbury. She looked tonight, she said, so like her mother, as she first saw her walking in a garden in a grey hat. And really, Clarissa's eyes filled with tears. Her mother, walking in a garden. But alas, she must go. For there was Professor Brearley, who lectured on Milton, talking to little Jim Hutton, who was unable even for a party like this to compass both tie and waistcoat, or make his hair lie flat. And even at this distance they were quarrelling, she could see. For Professor Brearley was a very queer fish. With all those degrees, honours, lectureships between him and the scribblers, he suspected instantly an atmosphere not favourable to his queer compound. His prodigious learning and timidity, his wintry charm without cordiality, his innocence blent with snobbery. He quivered, if made conscious by a lady's unkempt hair, a youth's boots, of an underworld, very creditable, doubtless, of rebels, of ardent young people, of would-be geniuses, and intimated with a little toss of the head, with a sniff, the value of moderation, of some slight training in the classics, in order to appreciate Milton. Professor Brearley, Clarissa could see, wasn't hitting it off with little Jim Hutton, who wore red socks, his black being at the laundry, about Milton. She interrupted. She said she loved Bach, so did Hutton. That was the bond between them. And Hutton, a very bad poet, always felt that Mrs. Dalloway was far the best of the great ladies who took an interest in art. It was odd how strict she was. About music, she was purely impersonal. She was rather a prig. But how charming to look at! She made her house so nice, if it weren't for her professors. Clarissa had half a mind to snatch him off and set him down at the piano in the back room, for he played divinely. "But the noise," she said, "the noise!"
the sign of a successful party. Nodding urbanely, the professor stepped delicately off.
He knows everything in the whole world about Milton, said Clarissa.
Does he indeed? Said Hutton, who would imitate the professor throughout Hampstead. The professor on Milton, the professor on moderation, the professor stepping delicately off.
But she must speak to that couple, said Clarissa, Lord Gayton and Nancy Blow.
The violent explosion which made Mrs. Dalloway jump and Miss Pym go to the window and apologise came from a motor car which had drawn to the side of the pavement precisely opposite Mulberry's shop window. Passers-by, who, of course, stopped and stared, had just time to see a face of the greatest importance against the dove-grey upholstery, before a male hand drew the blind, and there was nothing to be seen except a square of dove-grey. Yet rumours were at once in circulation, from the middle of Bond Street to Oxford Street on one side, to Atkinson's Scent Shop on the other, passing invisibly, inaudibly, like a cloud, swift, veil-like upon hills, falling indeed with something of a cloud's sudden sobriety and stillness upon faces which a second before had been utterly disorderly. But now mystery had brushed them with her wing. They had heard the voice of authority. The spirit of religion was abroad, with her eyes bandaged tight and her lips gaping wide. But nobody knew whose face had been seen. Was it the Prince of Wales? The Queen's? The Prime Minister's? Whose face was it? Nobody knew. Edgar J. Watkiss, with his roll of lead piping round his arm, said audibly, humorously of course, "The Prime Minister's car." Septimus Warren Smith, who found himself unable to pass, heard him. Septimus Warren Smith, aged about 30, pale-faced, beak-nosed, wearing brown shoes and a shabby overcoat, with hazel eyes which had that look of apprehension in them which makes complete strangers apprehensive too. The world has raised its whip. Where will it descend? Everything had come to a standstill. The throb of the motor engine sounded like a pulse irregularly drumming through an entire body. The sun became extraordinarily hot because the motor car had stopped outside Mulberry's shop window. Old ladies on the tops of omnibuses spread their black parasols. Here a green, here a red parasol opened with a little pop. Mrs. Dalloway, coming to the window with her arms full of sweet peas, looked out with her little pink face pursed in inquiry. Everyone looked at the motor car. Septimus looked. Boys on bicycles sprang off. Traffic accumulated. And there the motor car stood, with drawn blinds, and upon them a curious pattern like a tree, Septimus thought. And this gradual drawing together of everything to one centre before his eyes, as if some horror had come almost to the surface and was about to burst into flames, terrified him. The world wavered and quivered and threatened to burst into flames. "It is I who am blocking the way," he thought. Was he not being looked at and pointed at? Was he not waited there, rooted to the pavement, for a purpose? But for what purpose? "Let us go on, Septimus," said his wife, a little woman, with large eyes and a sallow, pointed face, an Italian girl. "Richard's very well. Richard's at a committee," said Clarissa. And she opened her scissors and said did he mind her just finishing what she was doing to her dress, for they had a party that night. "Which I shan't ask you to," she said. "My dear Peter," she said. But it was delicious to hear her say that, "my dear Peter." Indeed, it was all so delicious. The silver, the chairs, all so delicious. Why wouldn't she ask him to her party? He asked. Now, of course, thought Clarissa, he's enchanting, perfectly enchanting. Now I remember how impossible it was ever to make up my mind. And why did I make up my mind not to marry him, she wondered, that awful summer?
"But it's so extraordinary that you should have come this morning," she cried, putting her hands, one on top of another, down on her dress. "Do you remember," she said, "how the blinds used to flap at Boughton?" "They did," he said. And he remembered breakfasting alone, very awkwardly, with her father, who had died, and he'd not written to Clarissa. But he had never got on well with old Parry, that querulous, weak-kneed old man, Clarissa's father, Justin Parry. "I often wish I'd got on better with your father," he said. "But he never liked anyone who..." "Our friends," said Clarissa, and could have bitten her tongue for thus reminding Peter that he had wanted to marry her. "Of course I did," thought Peter. "It almost broke my heart, too," he thought, and was overcome with his own grief, which rose like a moon looked at from a terrace, ghastly beautiful with light from the sunken day. "I was more unhappy than I've ever been since," he thought. And as if, in truth, he were sitting there on the terrace, he edged a little towards Clarissa, put his hand out, raised it, let it fall. There above them it hung, that moon. She too seemed to be sitting with him on the terrace in the moonlight. "Herbert has it now," she said. "I never go there now," she said. Then, just as happens on a terrace in the moonlight, when one person begins to feel ashamed that he is already bored, and yet, as the other sits silent, very quiet, sadly looking at the moon, does not like to speak, moves his foot, clears his throat, notices some iron scroll on a table leg, stirs a leaf, but says nothing. So Peter Walsh did now. "For why go back like this to the past?" he thought. "Why make him think of it again? Why make him suffer when she had tortured him so infernally? Why?" The word time split its husk, poured its riches over him, and from his lips fell like shells, like shavings from a plane, without his making them, hard, white, imperishable words, and flew to attach themselves to their places in an ode to time, an immortal ode to time. He sang. Evans answered from behind the tree. "The dead were in Thessaly," Evans sang, "among the orchids. There they waited till the war was over. And now the dead, now Evans himself..." "For God's sake, don't come," Septimus cried out, for he could not look upon the dead. But the branches parted. A man in grey was actually walking towards them. It was Evans. But no mud was on him, no wounds. He was not changed. "I must tell the whole world," Septimus cried, raising his hand, as the dead man in the grey suit came nearer, raising his hand like some colossal figure who has lamented the fate of man for ages in the desert alone, with his hands pressed to his forehead, furrows of despair on his cheeks, and now sees light on the desert's edge, which broadens and strikes the iron-black figure. And Septimus half rose from his chair, and with legions of men prostrate behind him, he, the giant mourner, receives for one moment on his face the whole... "But I am so unhappy, Septimus," said Raetia, trying to make him sit down. The millions lamented. For ages they had sorrowed. He would turn round. He would tell them in a few moments, only a few moments more, of this relief, of this joy, of this astonishing revelation. "The time, Septimus," Raetia repeated. "What is the time?" He was talking. He was starting. This man must notice him. He was looking at them. "I will tell you the time," said Septimus, very slowly, very drowsily, smiling mysteriously. As he sat smiling at the dead man in the grey suit, the quarter struck. The quarter to 12. "And that is being young," Peter Walsh thought as he passed them. "To be having an awful scene. The poor girl looked absolutely desperate in the middle of the morning. But what was it about?" he wondered. What had the young man in the overcoat been saying to her to make her look like that? What awful fix had they got themselves into, both to look so desperate as that on a fine summer morning? The amusing thing about coming back to England after 5 years was the way it made, anyhow, the first days, things stand out as if one had never seen them before.